Our panel here is called Turning STEM to STEAM in Modern Curriculum. If you want to be in a different section, you may stay. It's okay. So thank you for staying. My name is John Maeda. I'm the president of Rhode Island School of Design, and I am the moderator today. Some ground rules. First of all, I would like this to be interactive. All of our panelists want this to be interactive. It isn't a YouTube press play video. So ideally, we'll each give short presentations. We'll save enough time to open up the floor. I will be the mic mafia person to ensure that mic moves around as much as possible. And hopefully, we'll all learn something together. I was just so impressed to meet Dennis Keeley. Is that correct? Dennis Keeley. Just met a new colleague from Art Center, a professor, head of the photo department at Art Center. And he was saying something that struck me, how there's bricks and mortar to education, and the mortar part is the interesting part. It's where the energy is. It's where the possibility lives. And I think that this group here, ideally, let's be mortary instead of bricky. You feeling it? Good, thank you. Feeling kind of concrete-ish. First of all, a brief introduction of our panelists. Let's see, to my right over here, we have, for this right over there, is Dr. Sarah Gantz, the Director of Education for the Rhode Island School of Design Museum, formerly Director of Interpretation and Research at MoMA's Education Department. She's someone who I've had the opportunity to work with at RISD for the past few years, and delighted she could be here to join us. To her left, we have Marina McDougall, art curator at the Exploratorium, director of the Exploratorium Center for Art and Inquiry, where she recently organized the NSF-funded conference on art as a way of knowing. I've known Marina for a long time. She worked on projects at the Media Lab as well. She's someone who crosses art, fine art, with a capital A and a capital F, I guess. You want to add the F and A. But also science and technology, with a curatorial voice that blends the two together. So glad to have you here, Marina. To her left, we have Deborah Gist, the Commissioner of Elementary and Secondary Education for the state of Rhode Island. She previously served as State Superintendent of Education in the District of Columbia, where she was responsible for all state-level education functions. She began her career 21 years ago as a teacher in Fort Worth, Texas. So you Texans out there, we have a bona fide Texas person here. And Deborah Gist, her career in Rhode Island has been marked by being really a national change agent, a local change agent, but also a national change agent for education. She was on Time's 100 list, honored there as well. So she's someone who's taking the national dialogue of education seriously, professionally, and we're so proud to have you here. To our left, we have Dr. Brian Smith. He's Dean of Continuing Education at Rhode Island School of Design. He was at Penn State previously as a professor of information science and technology, also professor at MIT's Media Lab, where he received the NSF Career Award. I'm happy to have you, Brian. So, let me see here. Let's start. Okay, so first of all, the context for this panel. And by the way, we've met multiple times before this panel, so we've practiced a bit, but we're very fresh, so we're kind of vulnerable up here. So it's always good when it's fresh like that. The context for the panel is this idea. And the idea is that the economy, as you hear in the last few years in particular, looks visually like this. It was okay, and then it got bad. I'm sure you felt that if you turn on the news, it's like bad now. But is it good now? I'm not sure. And it's gonna get better. And how's it gonna get better? Policymakers all say it's gonna get better because we're focused on education policy grounded in innovation as grounded in STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And what we've been talking about for the past few years is, well, STEM is amazing. It's transformed our economy in different ways. But also, there's also the right brain type of innovation in the arts and design. How do we put these two in a dialogue together and make STEAM happen? And the reason why it's relevant to my role as president of RISD is that I represent some of our country's finest artists and designers. People that make the things that you fall in love with, or you might dislike in some cases, but it sparks an emotional reaction. And if anything, I believe that America is about this emotional connection to something, liberty, freedom, happiness, all these things we take for granted is what makes our country great. And art and design ground that dialogue in something with substance, something that's physical, as an experience. And our institution represents this kind of ethos. It's done it for over 100 years. Now, I like to browse a lot, magazines, blogs, Twitter, just like all of you here. One year I found in Time 100 list this picture of Dr. David Ho. He's a famous HIV researcher. And I thought it's so interesting how scientists are finding that their own models of knowing and learning have limitations. And so I loved how Dr. Ho has in his hand a clay and dye model. You know, our regular stick and ball molecule models. So he's going off-road. He's looking for a dirty hand representation, channeling a different kind of way of thinking, of feeling, to look for a left brain innovation as well. So it's right and left together. And at RISD, we've been trying to bring together different parties to talk about this classic theme. It's not new, of course, art and science together, but we've been bringing together places, people like the National Science Foundation, educators in technology. Dr. Smith over here commandeered this particular symposium at RISD, which brought together experts in learning and science and art to talk about the very obvious natural intersections that you don't get to talk about very much. We also had another interest in people talk about big data. Big data. Well, big data is big, so you have to see it somehow because it's too big. And so data visualization is important, and that's something I think that designers, artists are making a difference around, because all that data, all those Perl scripts to process information are great, but you want to enjoy the data in some way. You want to build an emotional connection to it. So this is we have a lot of people working in data viz, or a lot of alumni in particular as well. We've also engaged the healthcare dialogue. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation funded a symposium at RISD to focus on healthcare and wellness, healthcare and art in particular. And students made all kinds of works, sculptural works, graphic design works, film works, animation works. This was a piece by a student to really show how complex that healthcare reform stuff really is. It's kind of sort of funny, you know, it's like, whoa, kind of thing. But these representations help you feel information, and the feeling is so critical to move to action. Now, why is STEAM important? Why has it been important? We can look back to history in America, look back to the car industry in particular, where everyone made cars for a while, but America distinguished its cars through design, making them not only affordable, but comfortable, something you would desire, you would want. And if you look fast forward to today, look at Apple and its success. An MP3 player was very common. Nobody wanted these things. Apple made them desirable through design of an ecosystem, design of physical objects. And so design helps to make innovations desirable. So that's why we've been trying to give focus to STEM. STEM is a great thing. But how can we imagine in America, could we pop an A into that? Could we sort of imagine an A bouncing happily from the left side and saying, hey, look, you know, you know, STEM, STEAM, you know, STEM is good, STEAM is good, let's talk about STEAM. And that's the subject of this panel, because we believe that STEAM can help our country find its economic sort of id. It's as simple as looking at our policies for education research nationally. And we've been doing it in different ways. You'll hear about that here in this panel. So now, and we have all this information coalescing at sendtosteam.org if you're interested later after this panel. And now it's my great pleasure to hand off to Deborah Gist. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, John. And I think it's important also to make sure that you are introduced to John, who is an incredible and dynamic leader and an innovator, which I guess probably is part of the requirements of being the president of a a prestigious school like RISD, but nonetheless, he is extra special, and we feel really fortunate to be here with you, so thank you for having us. We know that that art moves us, and we know that design intrigues us, and art and design are weaved into our lives every day, just as science and mathematics and engineering and technology are. And as educators, we have the ability through this effort to create something that is greater than the sum of the parts. And so when we think about STEM, the power of STEM wasn't in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. It was in the integration of those things. And so adding art and design into that through STEAM is not about STEAM. It is about the integration of those different disciplines. And I would add, along with other parts of what we do as learners and teachers. And so it may actually be the one time in which an acronym is more than just bureaucratic laziness. I would actually promote that it's important, the acronym in itself. Because we value not just the content of what we're teaching our students, but we also value and need to value that we are teaching them to think and to be, to think like and to be scientists and engineers and artists. So how do we do this? How do we capitalize on this deeply human attraction that we have to these disciplines, and when do we do it? Because this is our reality. Our days are choppy. There are tremendous demands on our time. We have increased time on things because we believe in many cases that we have to prepare students for exams. We've chopped up disciplines in ways that make it difficult to put them back together again. And there's an incredibly intense competition for resources in our school systems. And so one of the other opportunities that we have in the notion of STEAM, I believe, is that we can increase the value that we place on the arts by making them more relevant to our day at the same time that we're making learning more relevant through the arts. So to do so, we have to break out of what we know as school. And this is incredibly difficult to do because we know school, and school has bells, and school has schedules, and school has classes that have names like algebra and English, and that is what school is. And it is very, very, very difficult to break out of this idea of one-dimensional content. And we also have an unfortunate, in many cases, fear of new media. And you may know of schools where students aren't even allowed to bring their PDAs into the school, let alone an appreciation or understanding of how to help those tools become a part of the learning process. What we want is a situation like this, where these students, and this is a project that a colleague of my friends here, her name is Amy Letke. These students here, and this is in a school in Providence, were building kaleidoscopes. And in these kaleidoscopes, truly, all of the disciplines in STEAM were involved in the creation of these kaleidoscopes. But in order to be able to do that, we need to have conditions that set out to support, or at minimum, to at least allow, to at least not prevent this kind of work from happening. And so we have to have policymakers and leaders who get it. And all of us are going to have to battle against something that I am continually and increasingly frustrated about. And it's this battle between what I think is a false choice, a believing that we have to choose between student achievement, including student achievement as it's reflected on assessments, and rich, engaging, important, wonderful, joyful learning experiences. So in Rhode Island, we are tackling these historical and cultural barriers. And I would say that we're not there yet. State education agencies are not historically known as producers of dynamic innovation, perhaps even quite the contrary. And school districts, especially the larger they get, are the same. These are bureaucracies that aren't typically set up for change. But we've eliminated seat time in Rhode Island. We've eliminated course definitions, credit counting, and we're promoting regulations that we believe support innovation. But we have to do more, because we want to develop the kind of skills and abilities and knowledge and habits of mind that we know that our students need in order to be successful in the 21st century. We want them to be happy and successful in what they're going to be expected to do as thinkers and innovators and creators. So this probably looks familiar. And one of the things I was struggling with is, what is the difference? Because in a lot of ways, teachers have for a very long time done art projects. And I was trying to get at the heart of what is different, because it is so different. And I landed upon that I think the difference is crafts that display static content, in contrast with a process of creation, a process of art and design, as a way of exploring and creating using math, technology, and engineering, and thinking and being scientists and problem solvers and innovating and exploring and explaining and understanding our world. So as a quick example, I'm going to show you just a quick example, and I think we have to hit the space bar, John. Obviously a very critical feature. So you know, this may not be entirely unfamiliar, a performance at a school, you know, the puppets, that they've rewritten the play and so forth, designed the set. But I assure you, this is extremely different, because these are robotic marionettes that these students spent months and months and months learning to create, by beginning with Legos, going back and forth, up to a very, very complex robot that they created. They're not just learning math. They're using technology, understanding science, practicing engineering, and working with all of those to create something really amazing. So from my time as a teacher to more like, say, within the last year or two, when I heard Daniel Pink talk about the MFA being the new MBA, I really have believed in this. And I think intuitively we all know that it matters. But we have to make sure that as policymakers and as leaders, we are setting the conditions that allow our teachers to carry this out and support them in doing that. Thank you.
I'll do like quick summaries. Sort of. First of all, I want to note that Deborah's position in Rhode Island is really the highest position of education in our state, and her vision oversees the state's education policies. And it's delightful to have someone who has this vision of the future, but also recognizes the constraints, the good constraints of the present. I liked what Deborah said. We've chopped up disciplines and made it hard to put them back together again. I felt a Humpty Dumpty kind of conundrum. The difficulty to work in a one-dimensional system of bells, classrooms, you know, we take it for granted, but this is how it's designed. It's a design constraint. Third, adopting technologies. If you are on Twitter, Deborah Giss has a Twitter handle. I'm not sure how many state commissioners of education are so Twitter oriented, but she's always on there. We need conditions that at least don't prevent integration from happening. That's like a great minimal case scenario. And lastly, how she pointed out with this example that when you think about art and design, you look at the outcome, the thing made. But often what art and design is about the process of making, the thinking process around it. So it's good to note. Next off, we are handing off to Brian Smith.
Thank you, John. I loved all of your slides, but the one that struck me was the pie chart that showed the time that's spent in school. And so I'm going to try and sort of switch over based on that pie chart to actually talk a little bit about my world, I live in the world of continuing education. When the day fills up in K-12, we're here to try and sort of help out where we can. And I think that that's an important thing, is that, in fact, schools can't do it all. So when we talk about STEAM, and we talk about where to spread that educational message, it's not just in the K-12 schools or in the universities. We have to actually think outside of many more learning institutions. So in particular, I've spent a lot of time as an educational researcher working in the world of informal education. This in particular is a volume that was put out by the National Research Council a few years ago. I was part of a panel that put this report together called Learning Science in Informal Environments. So when you think about informal education, think about the stuff that happens outside of school. And in this particular case, we focus quite a bit on zoos, aquaria, museums, science centers, television, video games, internet, other ways that you would sort of get access to science. And this report was really a way to sort of think about and synthesize what we knew at that point in time about how people learn science outside of school. One of the things that came out of that report were six strands of science learning that were really sort of ways to talk about what are the goals of a science intervention, an educational intervention. And those were things like, you can see 2, 3, 4, and 5 here are actually, those were strands that were taken from an earlier report called Taking Science to School, which is an awesome name, by the way. Taking Science to School was looking more at the K-12 experience and what students come away with there. And so you can see that there's things like coming to understand facts, doing experimentation, exploration, manipulation, reflecting on science, and then participating in science activities. In the informal world, we felt that the informal world tends to stress two dimensions that formal environments tend not to. The first one is experience excitement, interest, and motivation to learn about phenomena. And the last one was develop an identity as one who knows about, uses, and sometimes contributes to science. So this idea of excitement and this idea of identity are things that, when I think about STEAM, I actually think quite a bit about what is it about putting the A in STEM that's going to try and sort of fulfill and sort of amplify the excitement that one gets from this whole idea of innovation and creativity. And then the second part of that being, what does it mean to then develop an identity, and how might STEAM actually help people become practitioners in these important innovation areas? So I run a program. Again, I'm the Dean of Continuing Education. So my area is I have kids from 5 to 85 coming through my program. And we work Saturdays, we have night classes, and so we're primarily, all non-degree kinds of things. So it's people who tend to come because they have some interest in the arts. This is one of our special certificate programs, actually, and I say special only because it's one of our sort of art-science combinations. It's our strongest example of where STEAM kind of comes to the road for us in my program. This is a certificate in natural science illustration. So this is work that is done by adults. They take 2 to 3 years to actually come back and do very intense work during the night, learning how to become scientific illustrators, and in particular, natural science. And so what we do is not only do they take art class, but they also are introduced to scientific phenomena because they have to think about form and function and anatomy. John showed a slide of the Nature Lab earlier. That's a place where all of our students go through to actually sort of really sort of understand and connect with nature. But the other thing you see at the bottom, this piece was done for Woods Hole Oceanographic. That piece over there was done for the Massachusetts Division of Fish and Wildlife. Again, another commission for the American Museum of Natural History, and then one for RISD's Nature Lab. So not only is it art and science, but there's also a component of professional practice where we put people into the world with mentors at these places. So one of the things we're, again, trying to do is to sort of set up this idea of not only are you artists working with science, but in fact, the idea of becoming a professional in this is very important. So there's this idea of identity that's wrapped around the certificate program. And one of the things we want to think about is, you know, how do we push that into other areas? The people who take this, again, these are all adult learners who are taking this particular certificate program, but the people who take it are like you and me. They're ordinary people with an interest in art and science, and they try and combine that to get this certification in the natural science area. They do not look like these guys, okay? So this is a standard kind of thing that we have in the informal science education world. It's something called the Draw a Scientist test. And it's real simple. You ask people to draw a scientist. These are middle school kids who drew these pictures. And this is pretty typical what you see when you ask them to do this. You get lab coats, and you get beakers, and you get some equations, and they all look mad, crazy. So if you want people to go into a field, you know, this is hardly the inspirational image if you're an inner-city African-American girl thinking, should I go into STEM? You know, I would do this, and then I would become a bald white male. I mean, that's not, who's crazy? It's not the idea. So when I look at my natural science illustration students, I think, well, that's a much better perception of what it means to actually be an innovative, creative person. And so one of the things that I think is important in the informal education world, and certainly crosses into the formal world, is this idea of really trying to break these kinds of stereotypes. So for me, in fact, I think a lot of what STEAM is a way to enable a whole different perspective on what it means to be a creative person. And I think this aspect of communication has to be one of the things that we try and teach. We can talk about making curricular changes, but ultimately there's a messaging piece of this that says the importance of creativity and the kinds of people who do it are not just scientists or engineers, but in fact they're often hybrids of the two. And so I would actually close here with an image here. This is a painting, Gallery of the Louvre, by a man named Samuel Morse. And some of you may know Morse. He was an acclaimed artist, but he was also a guy who invented this. So the same artist invents the telegraph. And there's plenty of examples of people who are hybrid artists and engineers and inventors and sculptors and musicians. And so the fact that these combinations often come up when you look at creative people is something that unfortunately doesn't get played out too much in our society. We tend to think of arts here, science here. So I think an important message that we have to also convey in the STEAM world, and I think that we have that opportunity, is really to think about how do we tell students, teachers, and parents that, in fact, creativity begins with people who are at the intersections of the arts and sciences. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. And it's important to note the contrasts in areas. Brian leads informal education. And Deborah leads formal education, and they both have different views on that context. Secondly, I liked how Brian brought up this idea of informal learning in that context. Two things happen. Excitement, a different kind of excitement generates around learning. Secondly, identity is formed, either created or reinforced. Form, function, anatomy, professional practice and mentoring, what happens outside the classroom is so important. Role modeling of integrative thinkers, people you can like look to a future career. When Brian showed us the Morse code person and the painting, I was like, whoa, I never knew that. Yeah. If I knew that earlier, what would it have meant? So how could you like know these things ahead of time as a younger person could change your career destiny? So next up, bringing up Marina McDougall. Okay.
Hello, everyone. Really delighted to join my friends here at RISD. I thought that I would share the philosophy and the approach to the arts at the Exploratorium, a place where we also kind of forget our disciplinary boundaries and kind of think of ourselves on staff as like, oh, I have that arts background, but I'm also interested in science. And so that just you just become kind of a person interested in the world. So we've recently come to articulate our approach to art and learning as aesthetic inquiry, and that's what my remarks will kind of center around. Hopefully, many of you have been to the Exploratorium in San Francisco. We consider ourselves an applied R&D lab dedicated to creating learning experiences that help people to discover their own curiosity. So different than the other panelists, we're really not so much in formal education, although we do engage it. We are really a museum. So this is what the floor looks like today. It was founded in 1969 by physicist and educator Frank Oppenheimer. It's considered one of the first post-war science museums. There were three that came about around the same time. And the Exploratorium modeled a kind of new form of public learning environment. marrying again the science lab with a public museum. So one of the main elements that distinguishes us is that from the very beginning, the arts were built into our culture. In fact, artists worked on staff and formed the culture. So art has really shaped our working methodologies. So we consider the arts, our philosophy of the arts is integral to our philosophy of learning. We take a very broad view of what learning is. And maybe if there were a better term for learning, or we might use it, because it is so bound to the idea of formal schooling. By learning, we mean that incredible human capacity that spans the arc of a person's lifetime, the potential to grow, to be transformed, to incorporate new understanding, new skills, whether that entails being enthralled with an insect or reading a book or learning Russian. We understand learning to be lifelong and something that happens both in the growth and development of an individual and among a social group, like a family or a group of chess enthusiasts, and also in the evolution of whole cultures. We also believe that learning is not just something that happens in your head, but something that happens through your hands and through our interactions with one another, and also with our interactions in the world. There was a great chart that someone at the Exploratorium developed that kind of tried to map that out, but I think that could be a good visualization for some of the RISD students. What does learning look like across your whole lifetime? So at the Exploratorium, we use the word inquiry to describe our philosophy of learning. Rarely do we use the qualifiers scientific or aesthetic, since there's a deep, almost unspoken idea that we benefit from being able to draw upon the full panoply of disciplinary lenses. At the Exploratorium, we embrace a holistic approach where art and science are integrated, just similar to what Deborah was describing. Lately, however, with the arts so undervalued in public education, it's become important to articulate our philosophy of the arts and to kind of put forward a rationale so that Exploratorium can help to advocate for the importance of art in education. So this is what we've come to. The Exploratorium views art as a way of knowing. Our belief is that art is an open-ended process of wondering, pondering, imagining, investigating, puzzling, figuring, apprehending, speculating, and getting lost. I think the getting lost part is kind of important, with the outcome sometimes being a discovery or insight that can be shared and communicated to others. We also engage the arts to draw people in, to induce wonder, awe, and curiosity, and to profoundly articulate questions about nature and human culture. So artists work on our staff. This is called Icy Bodies, created by staff member Sean Lonnie. And they deeply influence the museum's approach and our working culture. Art can be kind of a confusing term, I think, because it's both verb and noun. I think maybe someone was mentioning that before. It refers both to the activity of making art, to process, but also to the artifacts of art, painting, sculpture, etc. And so I think sometimes our head goes to those artifacts when I think today we're emphasizing kind of the process of art and how those kind of creative capacities that it builds sort of change your approach to the world. So at the Exploratorium, we engage people in both the making and beholding of art, both of which we understand as deeply participatory. Here's a few images of different forms that it takes. These were artisans from Oaxaca, part of a summer festival that was mostly focused on kind of the perception of seeing color, but by engaging traditional artists, it was sort of another way into something that might have been maybe more scientific in its approach normally. So the roots of the Exploratorium can be found in the material-rich experimental physics lab. Frank Oppenheimer, our founder, kind of got the idea from his work in Colorado at the University of Colorado. And it also grows out of this important work that was done to reshape science learning in classrooms in the post-war period, mostly beginning in Boston. The Exploratorium opened its doors with an exhibition called Cybernetic Serendipity, which was one of the seminal projects that brought together artists, engineers, and scientists in the late 1960s. And there have been some of us who've been kind of exploring how these kinds of roots have created just so many things that have grown kind of out of it since, especially in the kind of fine art world. Today, the Exploratorium continues to engage artists as collaborators who shape our methodology and our institutional learning culture. Artists work with us in the development of learning tools, experiences, and environments as creative thinkers, researchers, makers, teachers, and communicators who explore the world around us through the processes of aesthetic inquiry. So here are some works by different artists who've worked with us. This is created by an artist in residence, Sam Green, a film on fog. A group from the UK, Semiconductor, who worked in a lab to describe what magnetism is. This is from a Swiss artist who was exploring crystal formation. So last year, we put on a conference called The Art as a Way of Knowing that was sponsored by the National Science Foundation. And it convened leaders from education, science, and the arts, and to understand the role of art in interdisciplinary learning contexts. And from the conference, we were able to distill some key notions. We've just put most of the documentation up on the website, and the report's coming any minute, so you can go there. It's www.exploratorium.edu/knowing. But to conclude, I'll share with you a few of the kind of ideas that emerged. The world occludes the distinction between artists and scientists as both become absorbed in its vast questions. Art allows new ways in and through scientific material and thought. Art provides opportunities for synthesis and meaning-making. Making builds somatic knowledge. When we think with our hands, we deepen our understanding. We remake the world. So maybe in our discussion, we can talk a little bit more about art and these kinds of different learning capacities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who's been to the Exploratorium before? Who's read the book on it? It's an amazing book about the origin of a laboratory, to Marina's point, a post-World War II institution of science. And why is it important? It's important because many of these institutions formed by scientists who are grappling with the impact of the Manhattan Project, a project that created some of the most amazing scientific advances, a project that actually made scientists have to question the impact of science. You can point to the MIT Media Lab as part of that genre, scientists making the world again with art as a conscience, Exploratorium as well. So there's a wonderful story that underlies that, which we might want to ask ourselves today in how science advances. Who is in charge of how we think of the conscience of it all? Secondly, I think that going to the formal education from Deborah, the informal education from Brian, and I like how you brought up how the Exploratorium is in a different place because you can go as a family and go after dinner and hang out, which you can't do in schools. I don't think you can do in rural schools or in continuing education classes. So it's a different space. And so museums represent a kind of experiential learning, a societal, a social space that we often overlook. When you go by yourself to a museum versus go with peers or friends, it changes the whole thing. And that's the segue to introducing Sarah Gentz, Blythe. Go on, Sarah.
Thank you, John. So I'm going to try to pull all these things together. And I want to explore how works of art are the result of inquiry, of experimentation, of discovery, of innovation, but how they also offer us the opportunity to develop and exercise these skills. Skills that we've just learned are really the bedrock of both art and science. And I'm going to do this by looking at historical works of art, particularly works of art that we've been using at the RISD Museum to teach in our K-12 program. So through three works of art, I'm going to cover 500 years and look at ways of knowing and thinking in 5 minutes. So here we go. I'd like to start where art and science are indistinguishable, at a time when the artist was scientist, scientist was artist, and both were involved in a world of trying to describe what we see. This is a very modest picture, modest watercolor by the artist Albrecht Dürer. And looking at it, you can imagine that he sort of pulled this tuft of earth from the ground, and the leaves have started to yellow as he was describing them in paint. And that suggests the amount of time he took. And within this 16th century context, to create images from nature was a research method. And you also saw that still happening today in the work that Brian is doing. And to describe was a way of knowing, and he had to be scrupulous in his description in order to know, to the point that we can now still identify clover, buttercups, and red plantains in this image. And I think what's interesting about this rather humble and modest image, it suggests to us that to picture is to describe, and to describe is to know, and so that this rather humble image becomes a metaphor for knowledge of the world. A second example I'd like to suggest or ask, what do pictures ask of us? And at first, this painting is rather perplexing because it doesn't present itself to us complete. In fact, you might be looking at it right now and saying, well, what is it? I don't see anything. And what do we do when we don't know what something is? Well, the first thing you can do is you can start by describing it. So if we were to start to describe this image, we might notice that there are colors, that there are shapes, that there are patterns. But over time, you might also see that there's a sky, there's distant mountains, there's houses, and then you might also see that there are houses reflected in the water. And this painting by Paul Cézanne is not a depiction of the world, complete, but rather he was interested in involving us in the construction of the world. And so we are seeing two things at once. We're seeing both the surface of the painting, its color, its brushstroke, and we're also seeing the depth, which happens to be the banks of the Seine outside Paris. And so he's asking us to hold two thoughts at once, suspend them. And he has, here we are 400 years later, and there's this interesting shift from describing the world to being involved in the particles of the world, from description to analysis. And Paul Cézanne's paintings are always revolve around a problem that he set himself. And in this case, he was interested in time and space compression. And interestingly enough, he was interested in these ideas decades before Einstein started to wrestle with them. So what's interesting about a painting like this is that you can think of it as a complex body of information, a complex body of information that we have to wrestle with. We have to look at it, we have to think about it, and gradually, with friends, with colleagues, we can acquire an understanding, and slowly it comes into focus. And this is a thinking routine we actually use both with third graders, but also with medical students, this idea of description, deduction, and speculation. And so I started with a moment where art and science were completely separate, and I'd like to just conclude with a moment where artists are borrowing scientific information, and this is very much what Marina was also speaking about. Here's a work by Solowit. Solowit said he always started with an idea, and that made the work of art. In fact, he said ideas were machines that made art. And in his case, he came up with this idea of a 9x9 cube. And what you actually see is 9x9 cubes, 9 deep, 9 high. And it actually becomes a sort of pattern that invites us to start to sort it out. And in fact, he's been interested in presenting patterns that involves our creative processes to sort it out. And he wanted us to unravel it. And as you unravel the structure, which is actually quite monumental, you'll start to see patterns, you'll see geometry, symmetry, ratios, I think the connections to math are self-evident. But the striking thing that happens when we teach from this is that students start to see patterns in geometry everywhere. They start looking around the room and seeing it. And so what's interesting here, I think, is that a work of art becomes a point of departure where learning and lived experience start to become one. And so I think I'd like to make the case for object-based teaching and learning within the STEAM initiative, but more generally as well. Works of art present to us highly concentrated and multifaceted ways of engaging with the world. And sometimes, as in the examples I've suggested to you, they present us with information that we don't yet know, we have yet to grapple with. And through looking, through thinking, and through inquiring together, they can make us more inquisitive and far more creative. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Notes, artists were scientists, scientists were artists. To describe is a way of knowing. What do paintings ask of us? I never knew they were asking me something. What is it? I don't see anything. Artists are borrowing scientific information. And one thing Sarah talks a lot about is object-based learning. I love teaching and learning. I loved when she said, works of art provide highly concentrated models of the world. It seems so much better than like a laptop or iPad. It's like that work of art carries so much to understand, describe, and talk about. Now we've come to the interactive part. Great. Okay, so our panelists are available here. I prefer to sort of Donahue a bit, so I'll wander a bit. Who would like to ask a question of our panelists today? Yes, over here. I'll get back here. Go ahead.
My name is Judy Jennings, and I work here in Texas helping teams of teachers create lessons for K-12 education that integrate math and science with the four fine arts disciplines. What we find is that people who work in the arts get it really quickly because it's intuitive to them. It's a little bit harder with some of the math and science and engineering teachers, and I'm wondering if you have any advice for helping keep them, bring them in, because once they're in, they're really involved.
Excellent question. Thank you, Judy.
I think that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, who would be immediately drawn to these concepts? I sometimes wonder why I was, and you know, I was an early childhood educator, and so I think the notion of process and focusing on process and different things like that were maybe more things that I focused on in my formative years. I actually think, though, just the really high quality opportunities for those educators to come together and through inquiry experiences see what's possible. I mean, to see, you know, to look at Sarah's last slide and to be able to see the power in what can be done through art and helping the art then to make their discipline, you know, come alive for students, because all teachers are constantly seeking, how can we better reach our students? That's what we wake up every morning and go to sleep every night thinking about. And so I think just maybe making it come alive. And I would actually love to know what you've done and would love to chat with you about that.
Okay, I want to get more questions on the table so we could go over here. Was you next? And over there.
Next. I'm Giselle Huff from San Francisco. I was wondering just Sarah's last slide. So if it seems to be a very good way of introducing geometry and to younger children, making it exciting and so on. But following the question that was just asked, where a person is actually working to do this, how do you incorporate this in the training of teachers as a whole? I mean, when you think about what's going on in education schools now, it's like you want to cry. You know, how are we ever going to get that into the mindset of the people who are teaching our children so that they turn to those kinds of examples to help them make the case for math?
I think you've asked the crucial question, and what we've been doing is running professional developments
actually day-long programs, but also a few days, where we bring teachers together. And of course, these teachers are coming voluntarily. But the fascinating thing is when they start working together, it's almost we step away, and they begin to have those conversations together. So just as I feel I'm re-educating myself to understand this place between art and science, I think giving teachers more opportunity to sort of forge those relationships and inquire together seems to be working one way to proceed.
I would agree that professional development seems key. The Exploratorium for years has done has had a school at the Exploratorium which does teaching teachers and teaching teachers who teach teachers. And actually, it's interesting, just going back to sort of policy. Years ago, we actually had NEA grants to support teachers in those programs artists in those programs. And I want to use the word culture because, again, I think that's a key part of it. It's like, what is the learning culture? And you have to sort of build in the value for the arts within the learning cultures. And that can be a very, it's something that I don't think it can just be tacked on.
Okay, we have a question back here.
Thanks. Hey, my name is Chris Shearer. I'm with the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation in California, and I want to add one frame and ask one question. One frame is assessment. So much of what happens in education is driven by testing. And I think that we're starting to see, especially in schools that try and teach design and critical thinking and problem solving and problem-based learning, rich performing arts and visual arts assessments included in digitized portfolios at Stack year to year. So I think that's an important way for us to think about introducing the A into STEAM. And then the question I had was, given the president's report on the arts and arts ed and the nascent development of the STEM, the science standards that are going on at NSF and that ACHIEVE is turning, I guess, into beyond the framework and then into tests, where is that discussion? Where is STEAM in that discussion as we've got the first post-Common Core S in STEM coming out of the gate?
Well, I think you make an excellent point, and I would add, let me start with the assessment piece, and I would add something to that. First of all, I would say that in Rhode Island, one of the ways that we've tackled that is as part of our diploma system. Our students, it's their coursework, and course doesn't mean, it doesn't have to be class, so we've defined course broadly. Their state assessment, it does matter that they're at least minimally proficient, that we believe what they need to be successful in the world, but then there's a performance-based assessment to that, that is in some districts a portfolio and a senior capstone project, and in some places it's one or the other. And we think that that's helped to do some of that broadening. The other thing that I think is really important to that is the quality of the assessment itself. Because if the quality of the assessment is looking for students to apply knowledge, to think, to wonder, to problem solve, that helps then the instruction to be more than just about delivery of content. And I think that that's really important. In terms of the next generation science standards, our science content person in Rhode Island is the president of the state science, I don't know what their association is called, I'm sorry, and he's also the head of the group who's doing the work on development of those. So I can't answer the question directly, but I can tell you, his name is Peter McLaren, and I can tell you that Peter is very much involved in this conversation and the work that we're doing in Rhode Island. And I will follow up to make sure. I would say that my assumption would have been that they are making those connections. But stay tuned. We'll make sure.
Thank you, Deborah. And I just want to give a yoga moment here. We have 8 whole minutes left together in this session. Those are big minutes. Secondly, I want to point out Babette Alina. Can you raise your hand, Babette? Babette is head of government relations at RISD. And if you have any interest in the STEM, this team, please connect with her. Thank you. Over here.
Hi, my name is John Baird, math teacher in Houston ISD. Now you mentioned professional development. To encourage this kind of thinking. But I'm wondering, is that enough? I could spend an hour or a day in terms of integrating art and math, which I do naturally, by the way, but I do try to do it myself, but I know other math teachers struggle with it. Is that enough, though? I mean, simply spending a day isn't enough to, make them aware, but it won't change their mindset. I even wonder so much, can it be taught? Is it more, is it a function of, you know, I can drill it into you, or could it be a function of, say, MBTI, you know, sensing versus intuition, or perception versus intuition, whatever. Beyond that, even bigger, to what degree do you think our artificial separation of disciplines, you know, math in its corner, English in its corner, art in its corner, everything in its place, categorization, what degree do you think that perpetuates itself in our culture? What do you think, how can we utilize cultural forces, perhaps, to combat this?
I think that, first of all, I think that it can be taught. I think professional development and ongoing professional development is really important, but I completely agree with you that it isn't enough. One of the things that we have to do as institutions is to give our educators, all of them, more time together, more time learning together, planning and preparing. That's one of the things that we know that high-performing countries around the world do for their teachers, and we do it terribly. One of the ways that we can do that and lengthen our school days and extend our time for learning without having to spend more money is by rethinking our school days and taking advantage of technology. And Giselle actually has been instrumental in helping us in Rhode Island rethink the way in which we use technology through blended learning to extend school days, thereby giving our educators more time together, which I think is really important. And why I have the microphone, I completely forgot to make sure that the robotic marionettes, wonderful teacher in Rhode Island, Mary Lurgio, the person who does these projects, and she's amazing, and I just wanted to make sure to say that because I forgot.
Thank you. Brian, do you have a comment to add to this?
I think the point about the silos is very interesting. I mean, sort of thinking about the fact that we've had disciplines coming, you know, that if essentially art and science, people didn't talk about them as independent, then you start to look, and you can certainly look at universities and colleges and think, well, here are places that in fact continue to talk about, there's the arts and the sciences over here. And, you know, so I think one trend that's sort of interesting is that, of course, those same universities are trending towards many more interdisciplinary programs. And so to the extent that, you know, if the universities that in some sense are kind of this beacon of, you know, what is education about, if those places can actually start to demonstrate that there's really a need and a potential for this interdisciplinary work, I mean, I think that's one driver that could possibly help.
We have two questions left. Go ahead.
Thank you, first of all, for all being in the same room together and talking about these different things. My name is Geraldine. I work for Abracadoodle Art Education. We have a local office here. And basically, we work with every single one of your kinds of facilities. And the biggest frustration I have in my work is we teach art to kids age 3 to 12 primarily, but we go up to 12th grade as well. The biggest frustration I have is that we go in and we'll teach an after-school class, but the person who runs the front office doesn't really want us there because their day has ended at 2:30. We'll go in on a Saturday, but the museum person doesn't want us there because that's their art classroom. So I see in my very strange role this set of silos at work, and I have a 7-year-old. It's frustrating to me to see that, but at the same time, I'm very hopeful because there's a whole generation of people here having a conversation about all of this, sitting in the same room. I guess my question is, professional development isn't enough. There's a change of mindset, but there's a bigger change. I think our system is probably maybe three cultures old. It's still based on an agricultural system. And how do you see policy changing so that really we are focused on learners, whether they're 3 years old, 12 years old, 18 years old, 28 years old, 90 years old? How do you see that changing really at this point? Thanks.
Well, I think that it is in some of what I briefly mentioned, which is making sure that the policies support, encourage, and as I said, at minimum, don't prevent us engaging in the kind of change making that we need to do for this to allow this kind of learning and thinking to occur. And so as, you know, as examples, to change the descriptions of what a course means, to change the way that we count a credit, to change the way that we define and assign teachers and determine their disciplines, the way in which they work together with one another. So there are all kinds of things that these bureaucracies, that you're right, have been built over so many generations that are incredibly calcified, have to rethink and do differently in order to support this to happen. If this just remains a conversation that we're having at, in a room like this, and maybe some really inspired teachers who we know are already out there doing this, but they're having to push the boulder up a mountain in order to do it, because every time they turn around, there's a barrier in their way. We're never going to see the kind of change that we can see when we change those policies. So it's about policy makers changing the landscape.
We have 3 minutes left, and we may be able to do two questions, one here, one there. Go ahead.
Well, my question may have been answered, but my name's Taryn Kinney. I'm an architect with SHW Group in Houston, and we design schools. And I just, my question continues that, is not only do we need to educate the teachers and maybe the superintendents, but you also seems like we need to reach out to the facilities people, because the comment about putting all the disciplines in their corners, I think the spaces that we're in reinforce that. And if the math department's on one side of the building and the science department's over here and the art department's over there, how can we honestly expect these teachers to interact? And so I'm just wondering, as an architect, you know, we're willing to do it, but we are responding to our client, which is oftentimes not even the teacher, unfortunately. So I'm just wondering about education for everybody at the bureaucracy level.
And given a limited time, I'd like to end on questions. I have a question here. Just ask a question. And a question here to ask, and let's end on that. Let's use something called Twitter to ask your questions later. Go ahead. Yes.
So my name is Ludwig Herrera, and I am representing North Dakota State University at Distance and Continuing Education, but also as a father. One of the biggest questions that I have is, you know, my girl is in STEM, and we are all for the arts as well. But that comes from all of the people here in the room, I think we're preaching the same thing. You know, we're interested in science, we're interested in art. But one of the biggest things that I have right now is our society, our community, where we are at, they're actually not very supportive of the STEM system. So in reality, and everything goes with policy and bureaucracy, that comes from the society in all, which is all of us. So obviously we have to change the mentality, not only of the teachers, which they are all for it, but more than anything, us as parents. So how can we change that? Because that basically, we are the ones creating whatever we are into right now.
Thank you. That's the bell, I think. And this is sort of a, you guys had a good next class. And all the walls. I want to thank our panelists over here. Thank you. Thank you. And we have stempthesteam.org for more questions. And thanks very much.